The yield curve is when you compare long-term yield curves and short-term yield curves. And normally the long-term yields have a higher interest rate than the short-term, right? You're putting your money out for longer, so you should get higher. But occasionally they reverse. So your short-term yield is higher than your long-term yield. That's called an inverted yield curve. Mm-hmm. And at least if you study, you know, if somebody's Googles inverted yield curve as an economic signal, basically, you'll see, and you go back, you know, several, you know, decades in the past, and that generally every time the yield curve has gone inverted, within some period of time, it's like 12 to 24 months after that inversion, a recession hits. And so this is a signal. And as all signals are, it's not perfect. So it is one of the signals that I have, a signal in the noise, but I need multiple of them.
Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I am so excited to introduce our guest for the day, Scott Chopin. Scott, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, Susie, great to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited for our conversation. So everyone, Scott is part of the Urban Pacific Group of companies. They focus on workforce housing development in Southern California. I'm really excited to get into this topic because it's such a crucial area of work for where we are today with our housing shortage. So Scott, why don't you start us off by telling us a little bit about how you got into real estate and why?
So I have a family background in real estate. So my dad, Carrie, and my uncle, Mike, were both developers in their own right. Entrepreneurs, real estate developers, you know, deal creators, deal makers, but specifically in the development domain. So I had that background. I was very fortunate to have that background as growing up. Now that didn't necessarily teach me what a developer did or how that worked or why I would want to do it. And of course, as a, you know, kid, you usually don't want to do what your parents did.
Right.
After high school, I didn't really have a game plan. So I worked in the construction trades for a couple of years. And that sort of that time period really informed me about the future career choice I would have as a real estate developer in two ways. One is, you know, taught me about construction, but also told me like I didn't want to be in construction, you know, as an electrician, which is actually a good trade, like, you know, pretty clean, use your brain. So, you know, I was fortunate, I made a lot of money, but I also knew that wasn't long-term for me. Like I needed to have more like creativity, innovation, you using my brain and my knowledge and not necessarily, you know, physical work. And I don't shy away from that. So, taught me about construction, taught me what I didn't want to do, was continuing that. But also during that time period, I have been reading my entire life and I read a series of books that talked about how to invest in real estate, you know, really old school stuff, you know, how to make $1 million investing in real estate on the weekends. Uh-huh. And those books, one particular book taught me about deal making, right? Like what it is to create value in a transaction or a project or an asset, you know, silly stuff, you know, buy low and sell high. But really what that did is it opened my eyes up to what my dad and my uncle Mike did is like, okay, a developer finds land, creates value through the governmental approvals, the design, the build process, and the renting and leasing of apartments in this example. And then you should have, you did it correctly, a more valuable asset at the end than what it costs you to create it. So it's a form of value add. In fact, my joke is it's the most extreme form of value add for those people that are, you know, in value add apartments, like we're taking raw land and creating brand new buildings from it.
Do you remember the title of it?
It was literally How to Make $1 Million Investing in Real Estate on the Weekends. If you look that up, it's probably in print. I can't remember the author's name. You know, I won't even try to guess what the author's name is.
Yeah. But
You know, I mean, if you read it, it's really quaint, you know, probably it's like you go, oh, like, you know, YouTube and, you know, blog posts and, you know, Twitter and LinkedIn probably teach you way more. But this, at my time that I read that, that was what was out there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and you took with that and ran with it, which is, you know, it's one thing to read something and take in information, but it's another thing to like really take it to heart and then figure out how you want to, you know, manifest or turn that into something that you're going to be doing. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that it was teaching you what your dad was doing, because a lot of times I feel like sometimes it can be harder to extract those lessons from people who've been doing it forever, because it's just like normal to them. Yeah. Right.
And, you know, like, you know, I mean, I love my dad, but, you know, he was busy doing what he needed to do, et cetera. And that's no fun. You know, I don't like no claim good or bad, but I wasn't even sure this is necessarily what I wanted to do. In fact, I probably, you know, I don't know this for sure. I probably had conversations that maybe I didn't want to do it, right? I don't want to do what you did. So that would like be a teachable, you know, like space to teach. Although I do a lot of teaching for people who work for me. And you know, when I find people that are after it, you know, I'm happy to try to engage to advance their knowledge if I can. So
sure, for sure. Totally. I mean, it's just different personality types, different like circumstances, et cetera. Anyway, so you were saying you read this book, it taught you about development.
Yeah. So I think that was just like that informed my game plan. So it was, you know, I don't want to say it was straightforward from there, but it's, you know, I said, okay, I got to go to college. You know, I got to get a degree. If I'm going to work in the professional real estate development business, that's my entry ticket in. Went and got a finance, you know, business administration finance degree. And then purposely went to work for other companies professionally in the development industry to get like real active experience and knowledge working for, you know, professional companies that, you know, wasn't my dad's company, wasn't my uncle's company. There was none of that. Went after that. So I worked for a few years doing that. And then at 32, I launched Urban Pacific, which is now 21 years ago. Going on, would it be 22 years next March? So I spent, you know, like some time to prepare, right? College degree, working professional, get, you know, good amount of knowledge. Now, you know, looking back, and I probably would adjust a little bit how I went about it.
Okay, that's awesome. So you worked for large development firms. Can you talk about what capacity you were working for them in?
Yeah. So basically, you know, your entry point in the real estate development business usually is like an assistant project manager. So, you know, you're given the responsibility of, you know, marshaling a project through the entirety of the development process. The company I worked for was called Kaufman and Broad Multi-Housing Group. And I worked for a guy named Mike Costa. And the reason that's important is it was a subsidiary that developed apartments as part of a larger home building company. In fact, it's still around called KB Home, national home builder, but we built apartments. And one of the great things about working for Mike Costa, he had this philosophy that as a project manager, you did everything in a project. So a lot of companies in development, they go, okay, you acquire land, you build the building, you rent it, right? And you got a little overlap as you transition the project from one person to another, but nobody has the oversight, you know, of the whole entire thing, at least in a project management role. And Mike had the opposite. He's like, hey, you're doing everything. You find the land, you do all the entitlements, you know, we didn't build it. Like we hired a GC, but, you know, we worked with a team, but like I was ultimately in any project manager there was responsible for the entire life cycle of the project. And the reason I describe that is because that basically was the process that taught me how to be a real estate developer. I mean, I intended for that to be the case, but like it ended up that my selection of working for Mike was actually really ended up being great looking back on it, because not every company would train you that way. Like they may just, you do land act and that's all you would ever do. And I had intention and to be a real estate developer. Like I'm going to be run my own company. So I was after making sure that I got trained as best I knew how to get trained to be fully self-sufficient when I finally launched, you know, years later. And that's in fact what happened.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, I'm so glad you landed there. And that's really cool that he, you know, structures it like that. So then how did you feel prepared to go off on your own? Like, did you feel like, okay, I know enough and now I just need to go find the capital?
Yeah, I thought I knew enough, Susie, but looking back on it, it was like I was not fully cognizant of what I didn't know I didn't know. So look, as far as an operator, a fully self-sufficient project manager, when I left working for Mike, I was a senior PM, which means that I ran a team of other project managers who like were literally in the weeds on each of their projects. And then I had like a few of my own too that I continued to manage, but I was like managing other project managers would be the way to think of it. So I could like finding land, taking it through its process and all that kind of stuff. And I knew how to underwrite deals and I run pro formas. Like I knew everything. What I lack though, looking back on it, was the networks of people, particularly in the capital space, who knew me and trusted me as somebody who was in an executive role. So earlier I said I probably would have done a little bit differently. The change I would have made is I would have stayed working for other people for a few more years, get myself into more senior executive, like a VP of development or some, where I would interact more with the capital networks and they could have seen me be competent at a high level for a few years. Because then what you do is you leave, instead of at 32, you leave at 37. Well, now these capital sources, they've seen you in action. They know you and they trust that you know what to do, not only in the technical side, but you know, you're like, you create value and you do good deals. I missed that part. Or when I left at 32, I had capital networks, but they weren't like that type that had seen me in a senior executive role, right? I ultimately built that, right? But it took more time and effort and, you know, a lot more, you know, work on my part to create that. So I could have advanced, you know, I probably could have cut off, you know, 5 or 10 years of, you know, time that I spent to do that. And I don't like, I wouldn't change anything, you know, like I'm fine. Everything that I've learned has brought me to where I am today. So that would be what I would change. And then I think probably the thing, you know, which anybody who's, you know, seasoned real estate developer, investor, is just the really the reality check of going through a recession. So I went through the 2008 recession, you know, I was running Urban Pacific, you know, we were an 8-year-old company by that point in time. And, you know, we made it through, but it was hard and we learned lots and lots of lessons. Now I've carried all that knowledge that I gained working for others, plus building my networks, plus all the experience in 2008. And that's all come together. And now what is today is this UTH model, right? That's a, you know, the confluence of, you know, several different learning opportunities. And I don't sit here and say I've like got it all dialed in. Sure. But what I am much more cognizant of is what I do know how to do and where I create value best. And we're in those places that I either don't want to work, like I don't like to do accounting. I mean, it's necessary and you need to do it well. But there's people who are great accountants and they love it and they thrive on it. And I go, let me pair up and find that person, be as part of my network and, you know, take really good care of them. And they just go run through walls for me. And so it's like more and more I'm, you know, building a great team. We're getting the best of the best, the people who know how to do these different, you know, roles and play in those roles well. And then I start to like narrow up my focus on what I'm best at, which is creating new innovations, tracking market and economic trends and raising capital, right? And the more I can do of that and the less of the other stuff. And, you know, it's necessary as a developer, you always got to be hands-on. You know, I got to track where we are on project status. And, you know, we do our meetings to track, to do all that. But, you know, really using, creating, building and using powerful networks really is probably like the confluence of all those things today that I really work the most on.
For sure. Yeah. A lot of stuff there that I'm excited to dive into. I wanted to just circle back to one thing first, which is, you know, I mean, I'm sure you could write a book about what you learned during 2008 and, you know, the whole recession that followed. What are some highlights that you would want to share right now?
Well, I think the one that always comes forth for me is a term. I mean, it's the term I've sort of adopted, but it's called signal from the noise is how I describe it. And what I mean by that is I can remember in the probably 2004 to 2007 era, you know, I can describe that I read a lot. I mean, you know, nobody reads magazines anymore, but then we did, you know, we didn't have blogs and websites the way we do now or YouTube or all that kind of stuff. But I, you know, read the newspaper, I read articles, I subscribed to everything I could, you know, newsletters, the whole thing. And what ended up happening is in that era, I mean, it was such a frothy time. I mean, the market was just booming and the for sale housing market, building new for sale units was just going crazy. And I remember seeing articles like, you know, sort of like two versions. One was, this is the best market there's ever been, and it's going to keep going this way forever. And I'm being a little ridiculous. And then there's the other article where it's like, yeah, it's the best market we've ever been in, and you should be like scared to death. And I remember seeing both Mm-hmm. And like having this, you know, cognitive dissonance, like, well, these things are like, you know, this way, they're dead opposite. And I remember at the time sort of talking myself in, oh yeah, you know, it is so good. You know, it's going to keep, you know, I remember some article, I think it was like in the Wall Street Journal. And I was like, you know, the housing market's gone up for 30 years straight. And it was like a graph that went like this, you know, and it looked great. You go, gosh, it's just, we can't go wrong here, Sujia. Mm-hmm. And it sounds stupid now that I say it, but when you're in the middle of that, what I call peak market thinking,
yeah.
If you're not seasoned and haven't gotten kicked in the teeth, you just like, you get sucked into it. I don't know how else to describe it. And I'll be the first to admit, like I got sucked in, and at the same time, but maybe, you know, so there was this like sort of internal battle, right? Cognitive dissonance. Well, after that, the big lesson I taught is to pay attention to the noise. Right. Cause it's always there. All these different, you know, opinions and, you know, like this and that. And we're going up, we're going down. And it's forever. It's not forever. It's, you know, doomsday today. And it's, you know, never doomsday. And to really start to work on picking the signal out of the noise. What's the real data that I can trust, that I vetted, that comes from a source that I can trust, to even cross-reference, hey, this guy says this is going to do this. Like, what's evidence that says the opposite? Or what's evidence that say he's right or she's right or whatever? And so what I've sort of done is I've curated a source of economic, you know, people, of reports, of newsletters, of blog posts, blog sites, Twitter, you know, so they're my go-to source. And I really look at everything and I have trusted sources. And even then I'm like frosty is the terminology. I'm like keeping myself like sharp, vigilant, maybe would be a way to say it. And to never trust but verify, to use an old, you know, Ronald, attributed to many people, Ronald Reagan and the Russians, you know, everybody said that at some level, but to really look for sources of information, the signal that could give me some better read on the probability of what's going to happen, and mm-hmm. still even then not trusting everything, to still be prepared for the thing you think is going to happen to not happen. It's what I call probabilistic thinking. And again, probably a term I adopted, but what's the likelihood of this thing happening or not happening? What's the probability of this thing going on forever, or of it going up and then crashing, right? This is like market trends, economic trends, any of the interest rates, housing market prices, you know, the price of Bitcoin, you know, the price of Ethereum, in any market, right? Any market that you could think of. And so that's one thing we track. And then also to be using the same methodology for what is the future trend, right? Because part of, not only do we need to deal with what is the economic cycle going to do to our projects and our values and our rents now, but I have to be as the strategist for the company, as the CEO, my main role is to produce strategy that makes money for us, our investors, in the long run. Like, what's the future trend? So I apply both the application of the signal from the noise here now, right, in the present market, what do we do in the short, near term, but also signal from the noise for the long term. Like, what is, you know, what's the future of, you know, Bitcoin and blockchain? What's the future of 3D printed houses? And, you know, what's the future of the housing market in California? And then to start to apply probabilities to those things happening or not happening. And then we need to design our business plans and practices and strategies around that. So mm-hmm. I know that was a really long answer. So let me stop there and check in.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's fascinating. And I mean, I think in this space of development, it makes sense that you would put so much attention towards trying to, you know, have a read on the market and be able to predict, or at least be prepared for whatever might come next.
Remember, I mean, in development, we have probably 2 to 3 year time cycle to produce a project from the day we start it and it's mm-hmm. an idea to the day it's finished, might be 3 years, 4 years, 5 years in some cases.
Oh yeah.
So the time horizons are really long. And so it's like, you know, it's like turning a freighter, right? You can shut down a project. You could do that kind of stuff. That's more rapid, but we really have to be like several years in the future thinking about what's happening.
For sure. And there's so many different factors, you know, that go into the success of a development project, like, you know, everything from like construction, labor costs to market dynamics and et cetera. So, you know, I mean, I guess, you know, I'm really excited to talk about what you're working on today, which we will get to. before that, will you give us an idea of what happened during COVID? Like, and maybe we'll circle around to what you're currently working on, but that obviously was a huge shock.
Yeah. So again, back to these 2008 lessons, what had me, what, like, one, why we created the UTH program, and then what special characteristics about the housing design that we created were in response to things that we saw in 2008. So one of the things I learned in 2008 is that I don't ever want to be in a position where I'm forced to sell an asset in the middle of a recession. And so what that basically started to do is have me, so I'm tracking signal from the noise, and I'm looking for the signals that tell me that the, you know, we had a really good run, right? We had a 10-year expansion through 2019, even the beginning of 2020, if you take it to that. And one of the things they go, look, it's really long. It can't keep going. I know fundamentally that a market's got to turn down at some point. And so I didn't fool myself into thinking. So I go, okay, we're in a longest economic expansion in history. It's going to turn down eventually. And then one of the signals that I track is the inverted yield curve, which it went inverted in late 2019. It's gone inverted a couple times. And, you know, you look at it, it went inverted, and you go, man, the market's crazy great right now, right? So what all that did is it informed me that I said, I need to be in our projects long-term oriented, which means I don't want to build and rent and sell projects anymore because I might have to sell in the middle of a recession. So let's convert all of our projects to long-term hold, where I can hold such a long time period that I'm pretty much assured that I'll go through the entirety of the cycle of a recession and then be out, coming out the other end, at least having maintained my value, hopefully, and maybe increased, or at least not be, you know, destroyed or damaged in a way that, you know, takes me out of the game, right?
Can you just, for the listeners who aren't familiar, talk about the inverted yield curve and just generally, like, why?
Oh, boy.
I know that's like a big topic, but if there's... Yeah.
But basically, the yield curve is when you compare long-term yield curves and short-term yield curves. And normally, the long-term yields have a higher interest rate than the short-term, right? You're putting your money out for longer, so you should get higher. But occasionally, they reverse. So your short-term yield is higher than your long-term yield. That's called an inverted yield curve. Mm-hmm. And at least if you study, you know, if somebody's Googles inverted yield curve as an economic signal, basically, you'll see, and you go back, you know, several, you know, decades in the past, and that generally every time the yield curve has gone inverted within some period of time, it's like 12 to 24 months after that inversion, a recession hits. And so this is a signal. And as all signals are, it's not perfect. So it is one of the signals that I have, a signal in the noise, but I need multiple of them, right? And yield curve is just one of them. In fact, there's a website called econpi.com, econpi.com. And what they do is interesting is they take a bunch of different variables, like 25 different economic indicators, including the yield curve. Mm-hmm. And then they put them into the system where they graph the variables on a graph of, you know, expansion, decline, recovery, right? As like the economic cycle in a graph. And then what they do is they do a mean of the coordinates, which means they take the average of all, or the mean of all those, and they put them into one dot. They're all spread out on this graph. And you can track all how all these indicators signal expansion or traction, or, you know, we're moving towards a recession, that the variables start to move this way over time. And you can sort of look at it, and it's a big picture view of all these different economic variables. Because the trouble is, if you look at one, like the yield curve, well, that's just one signal. Maybe make a bet on it when you're inverted, but gosh, is that the right signal? Is that, you know, maybe it's different this time, maybe it's not. So part of the signal from the noise concept that I have is that I don't trust any one variable by itself. I have to have corroboration from other variables and look at it like holistically, if you will.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's in a nutshell, the inverted yield curve.
Okay, great. So I know you were going somewhere with that. Okay.
Yeah. So we were answering the question, what happened during COVID? I'm sorry, I get a real long answer, but it's a lot of good background here. So by designing the UTH model and renting to these multi-generational middle-income families.
Okay. So I know we talked about this before the show, but for the listeners, what is your model?
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-CAP.com, and sign up for our newsletter.
Yeah, so our housing innovation is called Urban Townhouse, or UTH for short. And that's basically a middle density townhouse rental product. So it's in the build to rent category of real estate development that's, you know, very, you know, popular right now. But particularly, we're renting to multi-generational, middle-income, multi-earner families. And one, that's an undersupplied market. But two, in answer to your question, one of the reasons that we travel down the path of that product type is that we always anticipated in a recession that these families, what they do is they circle the wagons. They get defensive in a good way. Mm-hmm. They sort of like, they bring in their family and they're like a protective ring. And the biggest way that they're able to do that is these families, because they're multi-gen, usually have between 4 and 8 people in a family, is they have multiple earners in the family. And this is a real key, because if you're a single earner household and the recession comes and you lose your job, well, you are now like, you know, you're like damaged in the recession. But the key, you know, thing about these sticky, what I call sticky, meaning they're very, you know, stick in place, is that they have a real resilience in a recessionary environment to sustain their lifestyle. Maybe it's not perfect, you know, they're not living a luxurious lifestyle, but what they're not doing is they're not being taken out of play, right? They're not having to, you know, go into foreclosure or go into eviction. You know, they tighten down the hatches and they tighten up the budget, but they have multiple earners, you know, they're entrepreneurial in some cases, like we talked about. And this is the real key. So we always knew that they'd be resilient from statistical analysis of the 2008 recession. Families are known to come together in recessionary environments. And we said, and we didn't know it was coronavirus, but I was in this, we're in a long expansion, you know, some black swan events likely to be the thing that kicks us into a recession. We thought housing would generally be strong because it was sort of had recovered from 2008 in a strong way, right? Not a lot of crazy mortgages and, you know, low supply. And so COVID hit. And of course, like, it was crazy, dude, right? Like, no one knew what was going to happen. So in you know, February, March of like 2020, we just said, okay, we think we're going to be okay, but let's be prudent. So we just basically finished out the projects that we had. We, you know, continue construction, got to finish it. And then we said, let's not do big, giant projects. We've got a lot of exposure to an unknown market over the next year or two is the timeline we thought of. So we started a series of small projects, again, in the UTH model, these 5-bedroom, 4-bathroom townhouses. And we said, look, if the recession, the COVID recession goes against us, we can be okay in these projects. They're not so big that they'll take us out. And we could keep maintaining our hand and play in the marketplace. And what ended up happening, Suzy, at the end of the day, is all our projects accelerated in a positive way. So we had faster construction because more labor was available because other projects shut down. We had more framers and electricians. And so we had that. Our rents actually accelerated. We had a huge pickup and from people who wanted to work from home. And so these 5-bedroom, 4-bathroom units became really unique when they were big. They had front doors that go out into the sunshine and the air, no common hallways. People were renting and having the, you know, extra room be their office. And so we actually accelerated. Now, like, we had disruptions in the sense of, you know, typically your movement time would be May because kids are moving to school. And so people are leaving apartments then. And then they look to start school in September. We lost the seasonality of what we typically have, you know. In fact, we had some of our best rent up in like the Christmas season of 2020, which is usually the worst time ever. Yeah. Like, you don't want to be renting. And because the September crunch had been delayed, it really got pushed into December of 2020. Because people in September of 2020 are like, God, we don't know where we're at, man. Are we in school virtually? Are we in person? Am I leaving my job? Am I not leaving my job? But we actually had some of the best rent growth that we've ever had. And we're always conscious of making sure we're serving these families appropriately. But the reality is that at, you know, $35 to $38.50 for a 1,750 square foot unit, we're probably half the market price of a comparable five bedroom unit, if they can even find them new particularly. So we actually advanced and accelerated in the recession, which if anybody's ever read the book Anti-Fragile by Nassim Taleb, he, you know, his idea of anti-fragility is something, a business or some organization or structure that is actually, you know, helped by being harmed, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when you lift weights, you know, you damage your muscle and then it grows from that, you know, damaging, but it's, you know, it's made stronger from the damage. So, you know, recession resilient, anti-fragile is what our, you know, business plan turns out to be.
Yeah, for sure. And what strikes me also about this business model, or, you know, what you're building these five bedroom, four bathroom townhouses, is that it seems recession resilient and that people are going to, as you say, come together during the recessions. But it also seems like a very attractive, you know, housing model that there isn't as much of right now. I mean, I come from an immigrant family, as we talked about, and living in multi-generational houses as an immigrant family is very common. In fact, we could have used another bedroom for, like, because, you know, we could only have in our four bedroom house, we could only have like one grandparent living with us at a time, sometimes two, if like, anyway. So it's interesting, because how did that factor into your decision to focus on this?
Oh, it was a key factor. I mean, again, for this multi-earner resilience factor. But the other part of what makes UTH, you know, resilient is that there's not a lot of supply. Like, we don't have a lot of, and really practically no five-bedroom apartment competition.
Yeah.
It's so far on the end of the spectrum of like, people. Like, I don't think people think it's crazy. Like, the people get it. Like, when we talk, you go, oh yeah, dude, my family could totally, you know, like, this is us, right?
Yeah.
But we get a lot of people, and particularly in the early years of the program, who are like, man, that's crazy. Like, lenders, mm-hmm. we took it to bankers and they're like, what? Like, five bedrooms? That's insane, dude. That's like, so we actually had to build a network of new people to us, or at least educate the people who are in our networks already to get on board with it. And that work turned out to be really valuable, because I'll share with you, we're in the midst of raising a $60 million equity fund that's going to be purely organized around the UTH model. Mm-hmm. And one of the key factors in getting people excited about the model to invest in this institutional fund is the fact that we've already done several projects.
For sure.
And completed them and sold them and produced great rents and great values and happy families. And I mean, there's just so many great positive aspects about it. But it really was an experiment. In fact, I call the beginning phase of the business plan, I call that our experimental or demonstration phase. Because I was like, man, I don't know if it works. I from my background in affordable housing and just being in the market in California for a while, I knew this was an unmet need. It was a gap in the marketplace. But of course, you know, being a developer is taking risks in an unknown, you know, maybe there's nobody doing it in that market because there's no demand.
Yeah,
I didn't think that. So we did small and mid-sized projects in the beginning in this demonstration phase to prove the model, right? That it really worked.
Right, which I love.
About the other end of this, you know, people go, oh, well, the projects are small. And that's fine. If the projects went wrong, I would have survived. So I had to make that bet. And that was the bet that I chose to make, but really is key, because people go, well, five bedrooms, I don't think that works. And you go, look, dude, I've done six projects.
Yeah.
I've rented, you know, umpteen number of units. Here's our family demographic. Here's the Concord study that shows 30,000 units of demand. I mean, it's like, we've really put together a great, you know, not only business plan, like a strategy and an action plan around it, but then actually proof of concept and actually, you know, real accomplishments. Like, we really paid a certain yield. Our average on the demonstration phase was 23% internal rate return to our limited partner capital partners.
Wow, that's like amazing.
That's a real, like, hey, like, look at the deals. You know, some were really great, some were okay, but, you know, on average, we balance out to this average of 23. I'll do that all day long.
Absolutely.
Like, fine. You don't like it. I get it. And less and less people are doing that. You know,
so here's a question for you, Scott. Like, what, you mentioned before the show that I think it was like 14 out of 15 of your townhomes were rented by Hispanic families. Do you anticipate that sort of, I mean, changing so that it's like more, you know, diversity in terms of who is attracted to this particular unit type?
Possibly, but it's purely based on demographics, Suja. I mean, the Hispanic demographic in California is the predominant and will be the predominant. I can't remember the, you know, total statistics of, you know, totality of population in California, but Hispanic demographic is the majority and the one of the highest growth demographics. I was looking at something yesterday and they had the highest growth percentage in that particular demographic. So the reality is that's just who's made up of, you know, people that rent and are in these income categories in California. To your point, like if we built in places that were, you know, concentrated Asian families, like we're in the San Gabriel Valley, huge Chinese population. I don't know if the income demographics are necessarily, you know, what would fit for us, but, you know, we're an open book.
And is that because you're working at workforce housing, or why would the income demographics maybe not fit for this product?
I think my comment is specifically that in the Chinese community in San Gabriel Valley, the incomes are high.
Yeah.
And so that propensity then has them be home buyers more than renters. So that's one factor. I think that's the predominant one. I think in the Chinese demographic, ownership is much better than renting. And if they have the incomes, and, you know, again, they do live multi-generationally and multi-earner households, and they're combining incomes, but they want to buy as radically as they can. Now, the Hispanic families, they want to buy also, but what we find the income differential is just at that margin where it's hard for them to get, you know, the money saved up, particularly to do that. Look, my philosophy is this, and I'll end my statement here. For me, I would wish every family could purchase a house. Like, you know, and even I used to teach my leasing teams, hey, if a family had an equal offer between our unit and renting a single family house, they're going to rent the house, man. Backyard, white picket fence. It's like the American dream, a rental version of it. And buying would be the same thing. But the economic realities aren't that. Mm-hmm. And so we're just building a product that's coherent with economic reality, which is some of these families, many of them in the middle incomes, don't produce enough income to be able to move into that for sale marketplace. And so what we're doing is we're supplying them a housing product that's coherent with their incomes and their family lifestyle, and developing a very differentiated product, you know, as far as a competitor in the development marketplace. And I go, great, you know, we're serving a social purpose of housing families, and we're able to do it profitably. And and there's a need, and there will probably continue need for a long time. And I go, great. That's a good business in my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love it very much. And I mean, it's serving a need, and it's just a wonderful business model. So when you say 23% internal rate of return, did you exit, and who did you, you know, who was the buyer for that?
So the first, the demonstration phase was a 4-project, you know, group. So that 23 is over that 4-project group. In fact, we're going to add a fifth. I'm under contract to sell our last of the demonstration phase, and I think that number may go up. But basically, this was, you know, return to LP capital. So we raised capital to build and you know, deliver the units, and then rent it up and stabilize it, and then sold. The buyers are, you know, just as you would think. Particularly, these projects were small and mid-sized, so a little bit more mom and pop. Individual investors, like one of our early deals was a small project in downtown Long Beach. The investor who invested in the deal actually liked it so much that he bought it and still owns it to today.
Yeah.
We've had, you know, just individual high net worth buyers. We've had exchange buyers, just sort of who you'd expect. And when you're looking at a range of project that's small and mid-sized, so not institutional, would be another way to address it. And really what people are attracted to is they're attracted to the whole dollar cash flow, right? These rents are big rents compared to the cost of buying it. And that it's a new product generally in places that you can't buy new products. So like our Fullerton project, you can't buy a new apartment project in Fullerton. I mean, unless it's like 300 units big, but if you're a buyer of a, you know, mid-sized project, there's nothing new to buy, like zero. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things we do is we're in these unique markets and these working class neighborhoods, and we're delivering a brand new product in that. So some buyers, like the buyer in Fullerton, was like, you know, I think generally okay with the neighborhood, but they were very, very bullish on the newness. You know, like it's a brand new asset.
Yeah. So with your future projects, how are you controlling or accounting for potential construction cost increases, et cetera?
Yeah, that's a real issue. And now, so So the pandemic itself during the, you know, what I'd be the heart of the pandemic, sort of 2020, early 2021, we didn't have any cost inflation that was noteworthy. In fact, we had a lot more labor available. So we actually got a little bit of price break, but more acceleration of the project, you know, production and process. So we finished our project in Montebello. It's leased up now, been leased up for a few months. And then we started construction on those small projects that I described, that we sort of took on a little series of small projects, you know, during the middle of the year in 2020. Those are starting to now hit in construction. And so we're basically, we have one project in Long Beach, our hometown, where it was the project that was right on the bubble of going from the old cost regime that we underwrote and did the deal on, and then the new cost regime on a go-forward basis with inflation, particularly lumber. So we're like in the rough installation stages of like mechanical, electrical, plumbing. So the framing is done. And so I joked with the framer. I go, "Hey, dude, you and me, we bought the most expensive lumber you will ever see in your lifetime. Like, you and I bought that." Mm-hmm. I go, "Congratulations."
Yeah.
So what ended up happening is, you know, we went from here to here on cost.
Yeah.
And that one project was the, you know, was on the margin, on the bubble of that transitionary period. So what that did is, you know, you go into a deal and you go, "Okay, here's how I underwrote it. Here's how I raised the capital." And then we know we have rising rents. That's happening now. We have rising values generally. The rate is hard to tell, but we're generally in a positive trend right there. And then we need to, so now we've got this new cost data. And so what you do is you go, like, "I got to, you know, make this project work." And so that's what we're doing with Atlantic. I don't know if we'll be highly profitable on this. Atlantic is the address, Atlantic mm-hmm. Avenue in Long Beach. I think we'll do fine. The investors will do great. I'm not sure how much money. You know, we may need to leave some money in the deal, and that's fine. And then what that did is that informed us, because we bid that project under the new cost regime, the inflated mm-hmm. cost regime. Mm-hmm. We took that underwriting and we applied it and re-underwrote every deal that is ahead, as after it in the pipeline.
Yeah.
And so, you know, our costs went up, like, let's just say about $30 a foot on hard costs. That's the number, right? You know, went from like 135 to 165. And so now everything's underwritten at that new level. And now lumber's come back down. So I actually think we probably gained a little traction. Like, I got a little room to maneuver on it. But basically, we had to re-underwrite every deal, new rents, new values, new costs. Right. Maybe. And I don't think we lost any deals, but we certainly tightened up our underwriting. So some deals just wouldn't make the grade anymore and had us be more picky about new projects. But now we've, like, sort of digested that cost inflation, mm-hmm. at least for the time period. It's ongoing. Right. But I'm looking, you know, copper's up, steel's up a little bit, you know, appliances are hard. Like, we've got supply chain disruptions. But lumber went way up to $1,700, you know, per board foot. Now it's back to, I didn't look at it in the last few days, but it's like $400 per. I mean, it went back to the mean. Mm-hmm. So I think we're actually going to, like, a lot of the $165 was in the framing lumber price, mm-hmm. right? That's $165 is the new number on our hard cost. So, you know, it's just, you have to deal with it real time. So these 2, 3, 4 year time cycles really start to, like, you know, affect you when you underwrote it today. And then, you know, a year later, you're starting to build it and actually bid it out. So there's practices that you do. So you're constantly updating your bids, checking with your subcontractors, your material suppliers. "Hey, how are we looking? What's the updating bids?" I mean, I drive my construction teams crazy because I go, "Dude, we got to rebid it. It's been 3 months." Again? Yeah, dude. Yeah. Right. Like it's a total pain in the butt.
Yeah.
But I got to know, as the developer, I got to know where I live, because if it goes up enough, I may just sit on that land and not start construction. Because what I don't want to do is build a deal that's negative value.
Yeah,
I'd rather, like, just sit on the land, talk to the investors and go, "Look, guys, we got to sit on this for a little while until the market sort of adjusts and hopefully catches up."
Yeah.
We haven't had to do that so far. We've been able to resolve everything. But, you know, that's real estate development, you know, in a real pure sense, is you're always exposed to that on an ongoing basis.
I know, for sure. Very fascinating. Well, Scott, thank you so much. I mean, you've just shared a ton of information and experience on the development world, and I just loved it. So thank you so much.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Great to
definitely
be here.
You know, I want to have you come back on and just talk about more about, you know, the different types of product types you think are interesting and all that kind of stuff. So
let me do this for your audience. Yeah. So if people go to our website, www.urbanpacific.com, You can get a hold of us there if you want to get in touch with us. But sign up for our newsletter. There'll be a red sign up button. And every Saturday, we put out that curated signal from the noise concept of articles and trends. Mm-hmm. So people sign up for that. Every Saturday, we'll write a little bit about what we're seeing. I mean, we put articles that we're reading. It's like our curated, really my curated reading from, you know, a week or two before we do the e-blast. And I think people could find some value in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So, and just, can you repeat where do you go to find
that? Yeah, the website is www.urbanpacific.com. That's the web address for our corporate site. And on any page, you'll see a red sign up button and click that. And that will take you to form to, you know, give us your email address and, you know, get us on the email list.
Yeah. Well, I hope you all take advantage of that. Scott, thank you so much for coming on and providing so much value. It's really been a huge treat, and have a great day, and I'll see you next time.
Okay. Thanks, Suja.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, L-U-X-E-C-A-P.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.